lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here, holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling when you feeling in flare. They can't catch it, it's havoc, I rip to a tear. Switch the scenario, my stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah, just nod your head with it. So explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it. No scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool. Hear my heartbeat beating to the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind, oh no. It's ponderoso, dope so. No overdose, cause it's dope, yo. Man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow, down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd know. We getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again, move little hooligan. Music for tuning in, full time to the 10. I'm on my clock like I told you, I'm doing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio Show. Once again with your host, Nick Burnaby, here on UCY.TV. I'm really happy to be back and still being alive, and I'm really happy to be joined by everyone. Oh, let me put my phone on silent. That was a little embarrassing. Really happy to be back, and I'm happy everybody that continues to listen to our show keeps on tuning in, and feel free to call us if you got some stuff to add, because I know there's a bunch of stuff that we talk about that maybe we're not covering the entire thing, or maybe you see it differently. I mean, we would love to hear your opinion on it. We're going to have an awesome guest tonight that we're going to talk about right now. And, you know, we've got a bunch of great things going on. If you do want to call in and join the conversation, the number is 718-717-8296. So you can call us and, like I said, let us know what you're thinking, or tell us to screw off. Or no, don't tell us that, but... you know,
tell us your fantasies.
Yeah, exactly. anyway, that being said, let me introduce our panel, and we got a great show in store for you tonight. Very interesting guest going to come on halfway through the hour, so we're going to get through a lot of this new stuff right away. First, my longtime co-host, DB Schwartz. What's up, DB?
Not a lot, Nick. I mean, there's always tons going on in the world, but, you know, it hasn't fallen apart as of yet.
Yeah. Crazy, polarized, divided world out there, not here, only in the United States, but all over, man, all over the world. It's really hectic, and we're seeing the roosters come home from all these bad policies throughout the world, whether we're talking about Europe, Middle East, North Africa, Asia, here in the U.S., Mexico, South America. I mean, just things are crumbling for, like, the... political status quo, it's just falling apart.
The veil of globalism's been pulled back, right? I think that's what we're seeing.
It really is being lifted, you know, and so it's up to the people who are well-informed and level-headed to try to steer the direction into a place that is not so awful. We talked about it pretty in-depth last show regarding the Brexit and... you know, the polarization that's going on in the UK and how there's a lot of xenophobia and stuff. I mean, leaving the EU was the right move, but the campaign was carried out in a way that was very Trump-like. And so we have to be – people need to, you know, fight with good ideas. And I think, you know, decentralizing, getting away from the overarching government of the EU, it's a good idea. You don't have to – sorry.
Some good stuff.
I shouldn't hit that so hard. No, I'm just kidding. You don't have to use xenophobia. You don't have to use fear-mongering to get good ideas out there, you know? And so same thing with Trump, man. If he's going to go up to bat against neoliberalism and neoconservatism, you don't got to be a xenophobe about it. But unfortunately, like,
people that run these campaigns, they play into people's emotions, and these emotions are real, and they use that anger to get elected or to get political stuff done, and that's not the way to do it. But, you know, that's the card, that's the hand we've been dealt, so we're going to have to deal with it as it comes. We're also joined tonight by our awesome journalist, Jake Anderson. What's up, Jake?
Not much, just having some technical difficulties, but figuring out. Yeah, I'm excited about this interview with the presidential candidate for the Transhumanist Party. It should be some very interesting futuristic ideas that our listeners might not have heard about.
So how do we pronounce his name? Because I don't want to screw that up when he comes on.
I believe it's, well, the first name is Zoltan, and I'm pretty sure the second name is István. István. I asked him when I called him last time, and I think we'll be all right if we say that. I don't think he'll get too furious and unleash an artificial intelligence on us.
Well, that's kind of relieving. So it should be pretty straightforward then, because that's kind of spelled.
I hope he'd unleash a robo lawyer on everyone.
There you go. So while we're on this subject. Because, Jake, we've talked about this before, and you've raised some pretty interesting points, and I think this our guest is going to talk about this too, so maybe we can talk about this with him. But we're going to talk more about your article that you had today, which was our top story of the day, about this 19-year-old kid from Stanford that basically created this artificially intelligent, I guess you call it a chatbot, that it's basically a robot lawyer. And it's already helped people overturn 160,000 parking tickets in London and New York alone. And it's an app called Do Not Pay, and it's very interesting. But this is one of those things, you know, there's been so much talk about robots, and we've covered a lot of it on the anti-media and, you know, some of the questionable things and how they could get out of hand and things like that. But this is a use of artificial intelligence that's actually really positive, right?
Yeah. The 19-year-old kid, his name is incredibly escaping me at the moment. He created an app that allows you to automatically challenge a parking ticket. It's a chatbot, and it uses a conversational algorithm. There's a lot of chatbots like this, but basically it gets smarter with each conversation it has, because it aggregates keywords and language and uses that to grow itself. The man's name, I shouldn't call him kid, I guess, but it's Joshua Bowder, and he's a Stanford freshman. And the app is only available right now for people living in London and New York. And in just those two cities, in only 9 months of operation, it's already overturned 160,000 parking tickets, saving $4 million in parking fines. And what I think is so cool, I mean, imagine if that were all across the country. But, like, what I think is so cool, I mean, this is kind of like, even he admits this is, it's amazing, but he even admits he wants to do more with it. And his plans for the future are incredible, but I think what I like so much about him is he really has a sense of social justice about it. And, you know, he's young, he's idealistic, but that's awesome. He's using technology to speak about that instead of just sitting around and complaining about it. Instead of sitting around and complaining about parking tickets, he got so sick of it, he actually created an artificial intelligence algorithm to challenge them. And, I mean, that's pretty quite literally taking things into your own hands, and it's really inspirational, I think. And it's also who doesn't want to root on someone who's taking on these policing for profit tickets, which everyone knows these are complete, a lot of times very arbitrary transgressions, you know, signs that can't really fully be read. You know, everyone knows, there's no reason to even go into it, everyone knows how arbitrary and ridiculous some of these tickets are. And, you know, he's taken matters into his own hands, and he's costing cities a lot of money, and guess what? That's money that they shouldn't be getting in the first place. If you want to tax people, if you want to earn money that way, okay, go about passing that amendment or whatever you need to do to implement tax laws. Don't do it through an urban taxation that targets vulnerable people who won't have time or don't have the money to pay it or don't have the money to buy legal counsel to challenge it and don't understand how to do something like appeal a parking ticket. So I think this the social justice aspect of it, to me, is the most interesting aspect, the most exciting part of it.
Exactly. And, you know, there was that you remember last year, I believe it was last year, when the NYPD decided that it wasn't going to be policing and it was only going to be answering emergency calls and things like that. And then the revenue stream started drying up for New York, and that's when the money started being cut off. Then the mayor was like, "Okay, let's make some concessions here." But New York, I think in your article you actually have the number in there. New York generated like $500 million,
yeah,
2014 alone, on parking tickets.
Yep.
So I mean, this is a huge source of revenue, and as you said, the parking tickets. In many ways, it's kind of a regressive tax.
It's a tax, yeah.
Yeah, and it goes after people who don't have the means to fight against these tickets because, you know, if you're rich as hell and you park down in New York and you get a ticket, you got a lawyer that you can call on to go get it expunged off your record. Or
they just don't care. They for them, like $80 is a splash in the bucket and they'll just pay it. And that shows the exploitive nature of it even that much more. But for people who aren't rich, $80 can be a bit like not the difference between paying a bill and not paying a bill that month.
Exactly. That could be your food for the next week.
Right.
And, you know, that brings me – I saw this interesting idea. I believe it was – they were talking about implementing it in Norway or somewhere up there in Scandinavia, where they were going to change – the ticketing system from just being like these rates, these flat rates, to where they would actually look at your income and then give you like a percentage of a ticket.
Flat ticket rate? That's funny.
So it would be pretty interesting because, you know,
okay, that's the opposite of flat ticket.
That was shot down by the wealthy, of course, because then they were arguing, well, then I'll get a $100,000 ticket.
Exactly. And you know, that's the thing, is that the so-called justice system in the United States, it's just by the way it's created, it's regressive. Let's think about it just to make it easy. If one of us three that are on the show tonight were to go out and have a few drinks and then we were driving home and we got caught and we got a DUI, I'm not condoning DUIs or driving under the influence or anything, but let's just say that happened. Here in California, it costs roughly $10,000 to deal with the DUI, not including the time that you have to spend in jail and the time lost, community service and DUI classes and all the other stuff that you have to go through. I would say it costs, adding all that stuff up, I mean, I don't know how much, what price tag you put on an overnight stay in jail, but, you know, that's worth a couple $1,000. I mean, a DUI, it costs an average Joe $15,000-$20,000 here in California. For me, if that happened to me, that would be devastating for my finances. Like, I'd be screwed big time. I'd be done. If you're a millionaire, I mean, first of all, you've got a lawyer, and I know many, many people with good lawyers, they get DUIs taken down to wet and reckless, which is like a misdemeanor, and it's much more minor.
Yeah.
And second of all, I mean, if you're a millionaire and you're out $10,000-$20,000. Big deal. I mean, it's not that much. Like you said, Jake, it's a splash in the bucket. For me, it's like a huge chunk of my annual income.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking DUIs now. Yeah, I mean, I think that would be a great app, too, if you can get past the social stigma of protecting people who get DUIs, which, of course, we should protect them. They have to be, it has to be proven that they were driving under the influence. And I think what's cool about the app, just to add another little detail in there, is that it mines a database of successful letters, and then creates a template based on those successful letters. And I think to broaden it back out, I really hope, what I hope doesn't happen, and I I'll be optimistic and say I don't think it will. Is it? I don't think he would commercialize it. He's very much against commercializing it. He wants to be free. He wants it to be free. And he, furthermore, he wants a revolution of people using artificial intelligence for humanitarian purposes. He's very frustrated by that. What I do think could happen is I think another company could take advantage of this, see the formula he uses, and then create a new one that does charge money or buy him out or something like that. That's typically what happens with these things anyway. But imagine this kind of technology being applied across the board. Imagine like an app that automatically requested Freedom of Information Acts on everything. So it was just flooding the internet with Freedom of Information Acts on just about every issue that comes out and automatically posting that information to social media. So we just had this constant inbox of crazy revelations, you know, if the bot, I mean, this is just an idea I'm coming up with. I of course have no way. I don't know how to create an algorithm or a chat.
And then the bot needs to auto hack if it's denied on freedom of information.
The bot. I'm gonna tell that kid. I'm gonna tell that kid, he should make that and make it so the bot will comb through the document and find relevant things. So it churns through all the legalese that no one cares about and gets to the heart of it. I bet someone could do that. Anyway, I'm off topic.
That's one of the problems too. And it kind of goes back to the Hillary emails and stuff. Like WikiLeaks has like a database of them that is like searchable now, but
all her dirty emails with Bill are coming out now.
Yeah. But there's so much stuff mixed in there that it takes journalists months and months and months to dig through this stuff. You know, 30,000 pages of documents. It's not something that's easy to go through. You got to attach like a whole team. If the New York Times or somebody big like that would have to have like a whole team of people searching through this stuff to try to find relevant information.
Yeah, the Panama Papers took them literally a year with a team of people going through it to get all the juicy stuff.
Exactly. When a guy like this 19-year-old dude could create a chatbot that, or you know, some kind of algorithm that can go through this stuff and find the information that we're looking for. You know, this is the kind of application for artificial intelligence that can really push forward the information war and just the human progress in general. You know, and this is the kind of application that, Jake, I know you're pretty optimistic about artificial intelligence, and you know, I'm kind of skeptical about it for certain things.
I just think it's going to be used for perverted things first.
It's like everything. With great promise comes great peril is the cliche, but it's name a great invention that hasn't been used for evil. Name an evil invention that hasn't been reappropriated for good. I mean, it's anything we create that's going to happen. Where artificial intelligence is different is that eventually, 20, 30 years down the road, 40 years maybe, I don't know, we'll ask Zoltan tonight, is that it's going to have the ability to rewrite its own code. So it's not going to be up to us anymore at some point. The artificial intelligence is going to have its own assessment of the world and what needs to be done, and we're not really going to have a choice in that. I mean, that's what I think, eventually.
And all...
Did you see Ex Machina, Jake?
Yeah, it's brilliant.
I mean, that's kind of how they're talking about self-coding, by using this constant input of information by using like a Google, but I forgot what it was called. Right.
Yeah, that part of the movie was really cool, I thought. But, I mean, it's the movie's brilliant, but it's still under the Terminator ethos, in my opinion, which is just this automatic assumption that robots are going to want to take over and kill us. And even though the movie doesn't outright say that, it ends with a very ambiguous note on what's going to happen. But
it's whatever a robot would see as ethically flawed, if I'm not incorrect. Like, she basically got rid of people that she thought was a threat because they were morally flawed.
Yeah, I mean, we should ask Zoltan this because, yeah, I mean, he has a very, I mean, some of the stuff he's written about the future of artificial intelligence is literally mind-blowing. Like, I read it late at night, and I had to stop because I was just like, oh, my God, this is just crazy. But crazy cool, and I mean, some of the stuff I think could happen, some of it not. But I mean, he thinks that that it's very unrealistic to think that the first major artificial intelligence will be created by a company. He thinks it's going to be a nationalist thing, and he views artificial intelligence as basically the next nuclear race, the next great arms race, because whoever gets
it already, artificial... Oh, sorry, Jake.
No, no. Whoever gets, we're talking strong artificial intelligence, not algorithmic artificial intelligence.
It would stand to reason with the budget the military's already got that accomplished, right?
We don't know. With DARPA, you mean? Like, I mean, they're definitely trying, and Ray Kurzweil's trying with Google. So, I mean, to me, that's a very interesting part of it is the private versus private enterprise versus government enterprise. And who develops it first? Zoltan obviously thinks the government's going to create it first, and that there will be literally different. There will be an American singularity, is what he thinks. But
$600 billion annual budget. I'm pretty sure the military is going to beat everyone.
Right. Yeah. And so I used to be very skeptical of like private companies doing it, but now I'm like, you know, okay, yeah, we're gonna go ahead and need you to do that because I don't trust the government. I mean, I don't trust the government with a comb, much less our artificial intelligence. I think we're definitely jumping ahead here, but I mean, it's a fascinating conversation that's going to, we're gonna be talking about this way more as the years go on.
Well, I just hope that people like this Joshua Bowder from Stanford, who created this lawyer bot, will be helping to lead the way in making some of this artificial intelligence standard where it's hopefully benevolent and it helps us, you know, and not sets us back a couple centuries or
yeah. I think this is proof that there will be positive uses for these kinds of applications. And when you're talking about exponential technologies like artificial intelligence, that the power of independent media and independent ventures is going to grow exponentially as well. So a single person with a crazy piece of technology is going to be able to do way more good or way more bad in the world.
Interesting. So yeah, we're going to be talking more about that once we get our guest on. I do want to touch on this bombing of the Turkish airport, man. I mean, again, just the terrorism is not stopping. We didn't really cover it on the anti-media yet, but it's just more bad news for, you know, just the world, dude. This terrorism stuff, and we talk about this stuff so often and how it's blowback and how terrorism actually is preventable, but we're not doing anything now to prevent it. In fact, everything we're doing is just making the problem a lot worse by intervening in the Middle East and bombing countries, and the fight against ISIS is just generating more and more terrorism. Now, this thing in Turkey is interesting because everyone knows that Turkey has been accused and pretty much been proven in many ways to be helping ISIS, in fact, over there, because Turkey has been trying to help overthrow the Syrian government for a while now, and so they've kind of openly been allowing fighters to cross their borders into Syria and get into the ISIS ranks and stuff like that. And then there were some accusations being thrown around by Russia that Turkey was actually buying a lot of the oil, the illicit oil from ISIS, and helping them, you know, and by doing so helping them finance their terror network and all that. So this is really interesting. I know I've seen a lot of reports saying that, you know, it's probably linked to ISIS, but if you think back to the last kind of terror attacks in Turkey, they were all blamed on the PKK, or the Turkish kind of separatist groups, which is labeled a terrorist organization by Turkey and by some other organizations and countries. But if you look back when Turkey first announced that they were going to be quote unquote joining the fight against ISIS, what they actually did was they went over there into Syria and Iraq on the northern side of things and just started bombing Kurdish regions and Kurdish strongholds and things like that. And now the Kurdish have been pretty much the only non-state player in the region that's actually been fighting and beating ISIS. So it has been very telling that Turkey has been targeting the Kurds rather than actually targeting ISIS. So I really don't know what to make of this. It's a tragedy. It sucks that all these people died over there. But to keep in mind, Turkey has been fostering ISIS, and they've been helping them and helping them finance and allowing fighters to cross the borders. So for a terror attack to come back and hit Turkey, I guess it's not all that surprising. DB, I wanted to know what you made of all this.
Oh, man, I have no idea, dude, because they opened a can of worms with their entire operation being found out by Russia and putting Russia imminently in danger, dude. And essentially, they made this wedge where they're kind of going to be let go as a fall guy by NATO if anything pops off, and it looks like it kind of is. I mean, a lot of things haven't been talked about regarding what Russia's been doing, because Russia pulled their troops back, left a lot of their air force, and still kind of are patrolling, but they're repositioning all their ground troops to Turkey, and they have been for quite a while. So, I mean, either they're worried about Turkey possibly just continuing to, you know, feed these dissenters, and it spills over into their borders, and they have Armenia. Like, Armenia is totally prime for allowing them to be using it as a staging, a place to stage, dude. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's very complicated what's going on in Turkey, because as the listeners are probably aware, Turkey is a NATO member, which means that they're part of the big military alliance of the West, which is the kind of the new empire of sorts, majorly funded by the United States, and we carry most of the weight on the decision making. So when NATO does stuff, it's normally the will of the United States. And so Turkey's a part of that alliance, and if you recall, they recently shot a Russian jet out of the sky, and that caused a real big diplomatic crisis over there with Russia, NATO, Turkey, and the whole region. Because, you know, here's the thing, is that NATO has like a defense pact. All the members, if they find themselves under attack, then everyone else is required to jump in and fight along with them. So if you know, the actions of Turkey recently, you know, supporting ISIS, or you know, at least indirectly, and then shooting down the Russian jet, these are actions that could have dire consequences for everybody that's part of NATO, including the United States. So if you know, the Turkish government were to start something big, it would drag us in. And, you know, this is one of the scenarios that is very likely could be the one that kickstarts some type of very large conflict up to maybe even world war, is this issue with Turkey. Because anyone that's been watching closely, I mean, the Turkish government is very corrupt. It's becoming very much like a dictatorship. Erdogan, who's the president, has been kind of usurping a bunch of power over there. He's been waging a war against press freedom. I mean, they have shut down Twitter recently. They've shut down social media. I mean, they turned it back on, but they shut it down to stem protests. They jail oppositional political figures and things like that. I mean, and this, the problem here is that the United States, not only are we hooked in with them with NATO, but we're also we consider them an ally. You know, we sell them a lot of arms, and we have a lot of diplomatic ties with Turkey. But it's not it's one of those countries where it's like Saudi Arabia, where it's like, why in the hell is our government friends with these people? But you know, for obvious reasons, as we've been talking about, you know, there's geopolitical reasons why we remain friends with these guys. And they allow these kind of geopolitical ties allow these countries to get away with human rights abuses and other atrocities that any other country, like maybe Iran or Syria or Libya or Iraq, wouldn't have been able to get away with. You know, and so this thing with Turkey is very, very complicated. When it first happened, I immediately have had the feeling that they were probably going to blame the Kurdish separatist groups, because that's the scapegoat for the Turkish government. Because you know, Turkish politics are very complicated, but there's a huge contingency of Kurdish people in Turkey. In fact, I think they make up almost a quarter of the population, and so they've got a lot of political, well, they've got a lot of, you know, potential political power and stuff, but the Turkish government does a lot of things to limit their influence within the government, even though they are Turkish citizens and make up a huge chunk of the population. They're constantly kind of marginalized and persecuted, and, you know, just bad things are done to them. A lot of their events are bombed. You know, there's a lot of Kurdish activists, Kurdish rights groups and things like that, and they're constantly falling victim to persecution and assassination and things like that. And so that's very, very, very complicated issue in Turkey. So this is something that we're going to want to keep an eye on and just see how it develops, because we're going to have to watch how the Turkish government responds to this, because being a NATO member, it has implications for everybody back across Western Europe and over here in the United States. So we're going to have to...
And one thing it could be too, and don't put it past Russia, because they are an empire, although it's much smaller one than we are, but they could have provoked this to happen to get Turkey to do something to them. In other words, they would kind of not trigger NATO if they were attacked, as opposed to attacking Turkey.
Interesting, yeah. And, you know, again, so many different crosswinds over there, geopolitical crosswinds. You know, Turkey, for the longest time, ever since, like, the days of the Roman Empire, and then even before that, with the Greeks and the Persians, and Turkey is a very, very strategic landmass. It's kind of the connector of the east to the west, and that's where a lot of goods cross, and that's also, you know, Turkey is also the destination for the oil pipeline that they're trying to build from the Sunni Gulf states. And, you know, that pipeline would eventually supply Europe with natural gas and stuff. And so that's why Russia has been so big on keeping the Syrian government in place, is because if the Syrian government falls, then the pipeline gets built, and then Russia's pseudo-monopoly on the natural gas supplies to Europe falls. And that greatly weakens their economic powerhouse, and it really puts them in a challenging situation geopolitically. So Russia, I think, would do almost anything to maintain the Assad regime, because they don't want to let that fall, because they will literally have their economy in, you know, maybe even on the verge of collapse if Assad falls. So, you know, this isn't a war. You know, everybody's talking about, and there was that recent, what was it, like, 51 diplomats from the State Department basically said, hey, it's time to overthrow the government of Assad by force, and the U.S. should lead the way. What people don't understand is that literally Russia will go all the way up to the point of a direct war against any other country if they try to overthrow the Syrian government, because it's just so important to them from a resources standpoint. They just won't let it happen. So anybody, any politician, this is what's so worrying about Hillary Clinton, is that she's already said she'd put a no-fly zone over top of Syria. The consequences of that kind of policy would cause a very, very, very serious issue over there, and it could, you know, wind up with the next generation of kids going to having to fight against Russia and the, you know, Eastern Bloc or whatever you want to call them. Not a good prospect, and that's why one thing that really frightens me about Hillary Clinton, even more than Donald Trump, is that she is, you know, willing to put the lives of a lot of people at risk just to accomplish these kind of geopolitical goals. But that being said, we do have a lot of other choices for president besides Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. I know the media, like, loves obsessing about these guys, and Trump said this, and Hillary's so amazing, and this, that, and the other. But there's plenty of other options, and tonight we're going to be joined by one person that's running in the Transhumanist Party by the name of Zoltan İsvan. And he's actually on the line now. What's up, Zoltan?
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for joining us. And we've got Jake on the line, and he actually interviewed you a few days ago. And I found the article really interesting, and some very interesting ideas that you have. And I don't think many people have even heard of the Transhumanist Party. Can you tell us a little bit first about the party in general?
Well, sure. You know, it is a new party. It was founded just about 2 years ago. And you know, its main aim is to put science, technology, and radical medicine at the forefront of American politics. You know, we have a lot of politicians out there that are saying a lot of different things, but really very few of them talk anything about science and technology. And yet nothing really is changing our lives more than science and technology in the 21st century. So that's what the Transhumanist Party is aiming to do.
Nick, you there?
Yeah, I'm there. Sorry, I had a little mic difficulty. Yeah, that's very interesting because, technology is what's fueling all the changes, these rapid changes that are going on. And I think that's one of the reasons why these politicians are so unpopular, because they're just so disconnected from reality. I mean, they're stuck in these old ways of doing things and these old solutions and this neoconservative and neoliberal way of thinking that people are just being left behind. I mean, people are just it's not that we're being left behind. We're leaving these politicians behind, and they're still trying to rule us with these old ideas that we're kind of outgrowing at a pretty rapid pace.
Well, you totally just nailed it on the head. That's exactly what's happening. And it's not just the politicians. I see this happening between the older generation and the new generation. Never in history has technological progress so quickly changed things. And those people that are used to change at a certain kind of pace are now finding that the change coming three or four times quicker than it's ever came before. And, the younger generation's kind of adept to kind of grasping that and upgrading and changing things and moving with the flow, where the old generation, they're still figuring out how to use the internet. So, and of course, naturally, look at all the politicians. I mean, everyone is either 60 or 70 years old, and I'm 42. So, even that 20-year, difference in generational terms makes a huge difference in how I approach the world and how I approach solutions to making the world a better place.
Zoltan, speaking of some of those solutions you have, your platform is actually, it's very detailed, which is what struck me when I first started researching it. And one of your, big platforms addresses, the outsourcing of labor to robots and automation, which is becoming a huge economic factor. It's going to get more pronounced with each passing year. And you have a solution for that, and I think it's a pretty interesting one that people need to think about, and involves the universal basic income. Can you tell us a little bit about your position on that?
Sure, yeah, and just so your listeners know, it's not because I'm a socialist or anything like that. In fact, I would consider myself more of a libertarian than anything. But no matter what you say, when you look out at what's happening in the world, approximately 50 to 90% of the jobs will probably be gone within 25 years. And the reason is that robotics and automation and software is exponentially increasing and improving itself. Just recently, they had about 10 big, giant 18-wheelers drive all the way across Europe without drivers in them. Well, America has 3.5 million truck drivers on the road, and those 3.5 million truck drivers are looking at losing their jobs, or at least having automated trucks on the road within 5 years' time. What do you do with 3.5 million mostly, males, mostly who own guns? And they're not going to go down quietly. They're not going to say, oh, I robot replaced my job and that's just the way the world is. No, they need some kind of solution when everyone around us starts losing their jobs. And of course, that's where the universal basic income comes in, where it's this idea that, if all these companies are making that much more money from modernizing themselves through machines and robotics and software, well, somebody and somewhere around along the line has to pick up the tab and say, well, if you've replaced 50% of the jobs and you've become super rich through that, you're going to have to pay for that. And, ultimately what that ends up with is a society, hopefully, that will end up having a huge amount more free time. No more 9-to-5 grind. You can go and get your third PhD, or you can go to the Bahamas and learn to play the guitar while drinking, a martini or whatever it is that you want to do. But that's the 25-year future. And I tell you, in 5 or 10 years, this is going to become the most important news topic of our generation for sure, because what's going to happen is slowly you're going to see friends losing their jobs just through robotics and McDonald's, just having people just pay directly into machines and the food being delivered. I mean, we have millions and millions of people that will easily lose their jobs over the next 5 years because of automation.
Zoltan, that's very, very interesting ideas there, because you know, we've been talking about this stuff on our radio show pretty much nonstop, and Jake and DB, who are both on the show tonight, can kind of vouch for me here. I mean, we've been talking about how this literally is one of the biggest political issues and economic issues of our time, but nobody's talking about it. None of these politicians have addressed it at all. I mean, not even Bernie Sanders, who is considered the kind of radical in the race so far of like the two mainstream parties. He wasn't even really addressing this idea of a universal income, but it does make a lot of sense in this context regarding the automation of the economy, because everybody kind of knows that that's the direction that we're heading in. In fact, I think that's part of the reason why Trump and Sanders had been so popular so far this election, is because, you know, the working class people are really starting to feel the effects of not only automation, but, you know, globalization and that kind of thing. But, you know, you make an interesting point. Is one of the things I wanted to bring up is that, you know, if these jobs are replaced and people lose their jobs and these companies are, you know, having, you know, modernizing and creating much more efficient products much more efficiently, you know, who's going to buy them if nobody's got a job left and nobody's got an income, you know? And that creates kind of a downward spiral where it's like a self-defeating prospect, I think, without having some sort of idea there to kind of fill in the gap.
Well, isn't that why they're trying to make the new Chinese middle class?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I think most politicians understand this concept. The problem is that it's such a revolutionary concept. And let me point out as well that it's not that it's like only the left or the right, you know, left supports this. Marco Rubio had talked about, this is a concept that Silicon Valley generally supports it. They support it because nobody wants to walk outside and be shot because, you know, their neighbor lost their job and you own a tech company. So it's something that's for the benefit of everyone. But yeah, I mean, one of the ways around this is to create a middle class and is to establish this basic income so you can buy the products that these completely automated, you know, companies might make. But really, you know, what we really need to take a step back at, and this is what I've been doing in my campaign a lot, is just saying, well, the version of the American dream absolutely has to change. This idea that we all, you know, we're all super competitive and we're all trying to become the top dog. Well, maybe as we move towards a new kind of techno utopic future, it won't be so competitive. There might be things like chips inside our brains that connect us much more closely, hive mind ideas, or we have artificial intelligence. There may come a time when, you know, being so competitive is not the way to move society forward, but efficiency and camaraderie is a way to move forward. And again, like I said, as kind of a libertarian-minded person, I don't necessarily, you know, subscribe to a lot of these ideas naturally, but I am believing in them because I don't want a revolution outside. I don't want the workers to rise up and say, you know, we don't have 50% of us don't have work anymore and never will again. What I want is for science and technology to prosper. You need peace. You need economic strength. You need, you need cooperation between nations and between people. And so the very best way for science and technology to move forward is most likely to implement a universal basic income so that we can all live much longer through the transhumanist technology that comes out. The last thing we want is worker uprisings. That just can't be good. And recessions are not good for the development of science and technology. So again, this is kind of why I support a universal basic income, and also why I would support the creation of a middle class, you know, so that there would be people that would be able to buy a lot of these products that these new types of automated companies would make.
Zoltan, you another major platform that you're passionate about is the coming age of a kind of new age of civil rights that's going to be introduced by transhumanist technologies, and you refer to it as morphological freedom. And we already know how contentious issues regarding freedom over one's body are in this country, and you anticipate we haven't even seen anything yet in terms of reactionary rhetoric and actions we're going to see when people start wanting to alter their bodies using technology. Can you explain to our listeners like what morphological freedom is and how it's going to affect them?
Sure. Well, morphological freedom is this concept of you should have the right to do with your body whatever you want to do, so long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. And you would think that's kind of a basic concept, should be built into kind of the United Nations, you know, Universal Bill of Rights and in America's, you know, laws and stuff like that. But it's not. You can't just go outside and cut off your arm and put on a robotic arm. In fact, even this little chip I have in my hand, which does little things like give you a business card instantaneously, or I can start my car without keys on, is not like technically allowed. And part of the reason is that the FDA hasn't approved some of the chips and things like that. And so essentially, there's the government has a stronghold on how innovation works when it comes to putting technology in our bodies. And the problem is that technology is growing a lot quicker than the government can actually handle the new types of stuff that is coming out. You know, most kind of medicines or most kinds of technology takes 8 to 10 years to get through a process that can be approved. Well, I mean, people are creating stuff. I can't even tell you what's going to happen here in 8 to 10 years, but there'll probably be a plethora of companies that are working on cranial implants and things like that. And, you know, the idea here is that human beings are changing because so much technology is coming. I have friends that within probably 18 months will start cutting off their arms and putting on robotic arms, because the robotic arms have evolved so far that they can now tie into your neural system. You can now grab a beer, you can now throw a football with it, or you're getting close to at least throwing a ball with it. But certainly within 2 or 3 years, you're going to be able to throw a football pretty accurately. And probably within 10 years, you're going to be able to throw a football way better than the very best quarterback on the planet. And that's revolutionary. And yet we don't have laws that allow us to do these kinds of things. So that's why the transhumanist civil rights is really important. And we've kind of put forth what we call a transhumanist bill of rights, and we posted it to the U.S. Capitol building last December, that starts to establish kind of what we hope that eventually the government will incorporate into its own constitution, to the U.S. Constitution, and say, well, yes, because human beings are sort of becoming like cyborgs and will, of course, increasingly become like cyborgs, should have some of these basic rights to do these things. And, you know, it's very important, because if we don't, we face the prospect of going through sort of a new civil rights era where there will be street clashes with people that want to upgrade themselves, but, you know, the government won't allow it, or the religious people in America won't allow it. So I'm worried that there will be clashes here in the next 5 and 10 years. And you're already starting to see, you know, a lot of the in the media. But that's essentially the field of transhumanist civil rights. It's evolving technology and humans wanting to use it, but not being allowed to because it's contentious.
Zoltan, I have a couple questions for you. First is, you know, there's been a lot of kind of pushback against, you say you already have a chip implanted in your hand. There's been a lot of pushback about that, and a lot of people are like worried that someday they'll become like compulsory, or that, you know, they can be used for kind of, you know, bad things. What do you have to say about that?
Well, yes, I'm worried about them becoming compulsory, even though I support them, even though I support children having chips inside them for various reasons. I think I'm worried that they will sacrifice our freedoms, that will increase surveillance and things like that. But I think one of the things we have to understand is the idea of surveillance, the idea of technology as a part of our lives sort of ended 10 or 15 years ago when we made this huge jump to embrace the internet and we all started carrying around smartphones. I mean, who doesn't have a smartphone in their pocket or within a couple feet of them? And, you know, we're being tracked by a number of companies right now. And certainly the Skype call we're on is monitoring this at some database, and government probably could access that if they wanted to with, you know, some legal incentives or whatnot. So what is the real difference between having a chip implant in our hand or somewhere other than what we already have? The only difference is that the chip's a lot smaller, probably cheaper than a cell phone because it doesn't cost as much to make. And it's just easier. I think once people sort of get over the fact that we've sort of crossed that path where surveillance and security and government intervention in our lives is something that we gave up in order to live better lives through technology, we'll be better. Now, again, I'm not saying let's give it up entirely, but I just think this idea that having a chip implant in one's hand is the mark of the beast, or, you know, some religious idea to it, or that it's something that the government, you know, look, the chip implant I have takes about 5 seconds to put into your hand. It's done through a syringe, and it takes about 20 seconds to uninstall by a little cut and then pulling it right out. It's not, I mean, yes, the cell phone's easier because it takes 4 seconds to pull out of your back pocket, but the chip implant in your hand doesn't take very much time either, maybe 30 seconds in max. So, you know, it's not like we're stuck. We can turn it off. We can cut it up. We can, you know, throw it away. We can make sure we don't have them. People, I think, will always have the right. But the real question is it going to be functional? And I think when it came to smartphones, we all sort of agreed, well, yeah, access to the internet 24/7 if we wanted, Skype on our phones, you know, being able to pay with our phones. This kind of technology was useful enough that we took some of the compromise of the surveillance issues that come with it. And I think that will also happen with some of the new technologies like implants.
Very interesting. Yeah, I'm one of the people that likes to embrace technology, but at the same time, there's always room for improvement. And, you know, we're starting to see more and more of like these end-to-end encrypted chats coming out. And, you know, WhatsApp, which is one of the biggest messaging apps in the world, is now starting to use encryption. And Facebook has announced that they're going to start using encryption. And, you know, a lot of the Apple products are encrypted and stuff. And so I think that some of the concerns people have about being, you know, spied on and stuff, we don't have to kind of forego technology to get rid of that stuff. We just have to have better technology and be more privacy-minded in our development of it and implementation of it. I do have one more question for you, and then I'm going to hand it back to Jake. How do you see these future technologies in their use with government? Because, you know, as we've talked about, these old politicians have really become obsolete, I think, in many ways. Do you see any of these like algorithmic technologies or future technologies being used to help in the administration of government?
Well, yeah, absolutely I do. And just reversing right back to what you said, I totally agree with you. The way to control chip implant technology and surveillance technology is to have a whole new generation really focus on making the security better so that we can count on, you know, whatever technology we have that doesn't invade our privacy. And that's up to the developers, the coders. And I, you know, whenever someone tells me, Zol, what kind of job should I go into? I say, well, go into security, to software security. You're going to be the hero of the 21st century. But, you know, I think when you come down to the government, what's really interesting is kind of going back is that the government is so slow to change and tech companies are so quick to change that this discrepancy between government and technology is increasing. It's getting wider and wider. So at some point, I think the government's going to sort of wake up and say, wow, you know, what can we do to remain on the ball, you know, and keep up with things like Google and Apple and some of the crazy stuff that they're all coming out with. And, you know, I have advocated personally just on it, and this is a little bit wacky, but there's no question in my mind that artificial intelligence will be here in about 15 years. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if it's here in 6 or 7, something that's, you know, its intelligence level is approximately the level of an 18 or 19-year-old person. But at some point in the next 10 to 20 years, it's going to become smarter than Einstein. There's just no question about that. And what do you do when you have an intelligent on planet Earth that's smarter than every single other human being? Well, first off, you better be very careful because that can lead down a dark path and the Terminator path, and we have to make sure that that doesn't happen. But it can also be something very good. And I have advocated personally, even though this would put me out of a job, but we're all going to be out of a job anyways, back to the universal basic income concept, is the idea that there might be an artificial intelligence president in our future. And why not have a bunch of algorithms and a machine intelligence make the very best decisions for the greatest amount of Americans? You know, that's really what a president is here to do, is he's here or she is here to serve the best interests of the people and do it for the greatest amount of those people. Well, you know, algorithms will probably be able to do that better than any other human being here in 10 to 20 years. And therefore, I don't see any reason that we wouldn't want to have some type of machine intelligence running our entire government. And it's not just the president, of course, it's all the other lawmakers. In fact, a lot of the reason people think that the field of law attorneys, their professions have been slowly declining the last few years is because a lot of legal recommendations can now be put to software and you can get good decisions that way, just like you can get good accounting decisions just by buying certain software programs. So at some point, all our professions will, especially journalism. I mean, journalism is one of the first professions that's going to go because of artificial intelligence. You can have a machine put together stories very quickly just by aggregating it. And, you know, that's the same thing that's going to happen with politics, is eventually we'll have machine intelligence that make better decisions for people. And those better decisions hopefully will lead to better societies, especially to an overall better country such as America.
Zoltan, I mean, as much as I would gladly talk to you for hours about artificial intelligence, but I really think your platform on the environment is important. And I want our listeners to hear your take, because the environment is such an important issue. And if you could share with us your belief on how technology is going to help the environment.
Well, sure. And just so your listeners know, you know, I began my career as a journalist, and I began that career at National Geographic. So I've essentially was doing environmental wildlife stories and humanitarian stories for most of my career before I kind of became a writer and a politician, or an aspiring politician. So I've been very involved with protecting the environment, protecting for rainforest and wildlife. And I even was a communication director at WildAid in Southeast Asia for 2 years. So I have a very strong desire to make the earth pristine, but I've realized that the way to make it pristine, because it's, if you can tell, if you just look outside and you look at the news, we're not doing a good job taking care of the planet. There's too many people. There's too many people wanting to make money. There's too many factories. There's too many people eating meat. You know, we've dedicated now a third of the arable land on planet Earth to growing meat. Well, how can we fix the environmental problems with technology and science? Because obviously we can't solve it just by passing laws, you know, like the Paris or the Kyoto Protocol or some of these other things. It just doesn't work. I mean, you can't stop China and India from developing, but science can change it. Things like nanotechnology, things like genetics, when you're talking about reviving species that went extinct or almost extinct, these are the types of science and technological things that can change the way we face the entire environmental catastrophe that we've sort of created. And, you know, there's two great examples I often talk about. I told you a third of the arable land has been dedicated to grazing cattle. And, of course, to have cattle grown, you had to cut down all these beautiful rainforests. So that's where all these rainforests have gone. One, you know, country, for example, Paraguay, has cut down 92% of its rainforest for cattle. Well, meatless meat is now being made in factories. You know, one of the Google brothers is really behind this, and a couple of other now entrepreneurs are starting to make meatless meat in factories. So you don't need to cut down rainforests anymore to have people have their meat. And then you could grow back those rainforests and you could solve the greenhouse problems. And this is a great way that technology could help the environment. But, you know, what I was doing with WildAid in Cambodia was trying to stop poaching. And we just were not able to stop the poaching on a level that actually made a difference from wildlife species regaining their numbers and surviving. But now, because of things like CRISPR technology and genetic editing and genetic technologies, we're going to have the ability here for just peanuts, not much money, to go in and say, we're going to drop 5,000 tigers, you know, create them in a laboratory, and then go spawn them out in the forest and totally replenish the tiger population in Southeast Asia, which is basically down to nothing now. And because of China eating it for, you know, whatever reasons and its medicinal reasons, that's the way to solve the wildlife population problems that we're having all around the world with endangered species. It may not be to stop the poaching, it's so hard to tell a farmer in Cambodia, don't kill a tiger, when he knows he's going to get $10,000, and $10,000 is more money than he'll get in a lifetime. You just can't tell a very poor person who's trying to feed his family to do that. What you can do is, in the laboratory in America or somewhere else, create, you know, 10,000 tigers, you know, embryos, and feed them through the system and then replenish populations. That's the way that science and technology can rehabilitate the earth and bring about this utopic paradise that we used to live in. And that's why I really advocate not lessening the carbon footprint that humans have, but increasing the resources and the money that's going into environmental science, specifically the kinds of science that can change the environment back to a really beautiful place.
Zoltan, we can also maybe drop the tigers right on the poachers. We're out of time, though. Can you quickly tell our audience where they can support your campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. Just go to my website. It's ZoltanIshvan.com, and you can follow me on social media. And we also have the
stereo. Yo, here we go. Go through the stereo. Stereo.
This is Aussie Skateboard,